The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Okay, now here's a tree. This here is a tree.
That's a little skimpy in the front.
Well, you just put it in the corner.
Haven't you got a big tree?
Yeah. Hell, this ain't no tree. Now here's a tree. This here is a tree.
Oh, wait till the dog sees that one, huh?
Don't you think it's a little large?
No, Christmas only comes once a year. Why not?
Why not? I'll throw in some rope and tie it to your car for you.
You got a deal. Deal.
Jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey! Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, January the 7th, 2026. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughn.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
The spirit of Christmas that was captured in our show opener from the movie A Christmas Story is reflective of a culture that was experienced by both myself and Robert when we were much younger. In his December 26 discussion with Rashid Muhammad, host of the Red Pill Diaries, on whose show Robert appeared, Robert lamented that this culture will never return. Rashid has kindly given us permission to air his podcast interview with Robert on today's Just Right, again, an interview that exceeds the time constraints of our broadcast, but which can be accessed entirely in its original video format on the homepage of Just Right Media, and of course, on the various platforms on which Red Pill Diaries is accessible. Their discussion addressed the incredible speed with which cultures change and how that change has manifested itself in the zeitgeist of 2026. So, with Rashid as the host and with Robert as the guest, this should prove to be a unique Just Right experience that begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible.
Greetings, everyone, and thank you for another edition of the Red Pill Diaries. And I want to bring our esteemed guest right in, and I'll let him introduce himself and his qualifications. Thank you so much for joining us today. Could you please introduce yourself to the audience that will be watching you shortly?
Of course, Rashid. First of all, it's good to see you. Thank you for the invitation. We've had a mutual friend, and this is how we met, through Salim Mansour, who I've known for at least 25 years. He was a great guy and so informative. But first of all, myself, I mean, Robert Vaughn, I'm a associate, if you will, at Just Right Media, and that's justrightmedia.org. For anybody who wants to go there and see my body of work with my co-host, Robert Metz. But education-wise and work-wise, I have a degree in psychology, Bachelor of Science, which is an unusual degree for psychology, but I got it because more or less of neuroscience. And I worked at the same university that Salim worked at, University of Western Ontario, clinical neurological science, family medicine, physiology. So that's my strength, where Salim's maybe history and geopolitics and political economics. Mine is more psychology, philosophy. And along those lines, I've worked behind the scenes for a number of political parties, People's Party of Canada. I've been documenting them, Freedom Party of Ontario, Canadian Alliance. Both Salim and I ran for the Canadian Alliance. Oh, gosh, that must be in 2000, I think. And I was Salim Mansour's campaign manager in 2019 when he ran for the People's Party of Canada. So I try not to get into politics myself personally up front. I like working behind the scenes, although I did run for federal parliament, and I have been elected to public office with the Board of Education for the City of London as a trustee, and then when they amalgamated Thames Valley District School Board as a trustee. So I know a little bit about door knocking, pamphleteering, knocking on doors, trying to press the flesh and get people to come over to your side of the story. So that's, in a nutshell, that's what I am.
And so since you're dealing with the psychology, the makeup of psychology, what kind of mind state is the Western leadership in as we see them run roughshod over their own laws, regulations, rules, and the sovereignty that they claim that every other nation can have as long as the sovereignty is submissive to Western domination?
Well, first of all, I should probably categorize this. I think maybe you're generalizing for the United States and Europe. Western, I mean, you've got South America in there as well, Caribbean countries. They more or less keep to themselves. Mm-hmm. So for as far as Western leaders go, I think we're talking more or less with the United States preeminent, but then you have Macron and you have the European leaders who seem to want to embroil themselves into conflicts that really have not a lot to do with them personally, and especially the United States and Canada. And I think we can talk almost as cousins in this respect, because when you roll over in bed, we get crushed. So that's how close we are geopolitically. So what is the mindset, the psychology of it? I've had epiphanies over the last 5 years, and you know what I'm talking about with the COVID tyranny that happened. And I'm not the only one. A lot of people thought of things academically or detached. What happened in Nazi Germany is always the big thing, you know, like why did people do what they did? But I think for me, what happened was it came personal when I saw that our own country was doing such draconian things. And I came to realize that these people don't have our best interests at heart. None of them do. None of the Western leaders, in my estimation, have our best interests as the people at heart. They're corrupt morally. They are gangsters. What other word can we describe them as? Thugs, with rare exception. With rare exception. And there's always exceptions to this generalization. And I would not want to smear everybody with the same brush. But they're few and far between. I think that politics gravitates psychopaths and sociopaths. And there's a bit of a distinction there. Psychopath, if you will, is born without any empathy or the ability to empathize. And a sociopath is bred that way through the environment. Something happens so that they turn out to be really despicable people who may do harm. They may lose a little sleep over it, but they'll do it anyway. That's a sociopath. This is describing, I think, the politics and the politics from the way I see it in our parliament, to the House of Representatives, to your Senate, to the members of parliament in the UK, especially these are the parliaments and the bodies of politics that I seem to know best. My own, of course, yours, because everybody knows American politics. They have to. And that's my estimation. They're gangsters, they're thugs, they don't care. But the psychology of it and the philosophy of it goes back maybe to Karl Marx, Communist Manifesto. I think he started it off by saying there's a specter hanging over Europe. The specter is communism. And he tried to explain through his manifesto what communism was. This may take a little while. Do you have some time?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Today begins a new era. I stand alongside over 1 million New Yorkers who voted for this day nearly 2 months ago. And I stand just as resolutely alongside those who did not. I know there are some who view this administration with distrust or disdain, or who see politics as permanently broken. And while only action can change minds, I promise you this. If you are a New Yorker, I am your mayor. I thank the labor and movement leaders here today, the activists and the elected officials who will return to fighting for New Yorkers the second this ceremony concludes. A moment like this comes rarely. Seldom do we hold such an opportunity to transform and reinvent. Beginning today, we will govern expansively and audaciously. For too long, we have turned to the private sector for greatness while accepting mediocrity from those who serve the public. I cannot blame anyone who has come to question the role of government, whose faith in democracy has been eroded by decades of apathy. We will restore that trust by walking a different path, one where government is no longer solely the final recourse for those struggling, one where excellence is no longer the exception. In a city where the mere names of our streets are associated with the innovation of the industries that call them home, we will make the word City Hall synonymous with both resolve and results. We will replace the frigidity of rugged individualism with the warmth of collectivism. Here, where the language of the New Deal was born, the cost of childcare will no longer discourage young adults from starting a family. Because we will deliver universal childcare for the many by taxing the wealthiest few. Those in rent-stabilized homes will no longer dread the latest rent hike, because we will freeze the rent. Getting on a bus without worrying about a fare hike or whether you'll be able to get to your destination on time will no longer be deemed a small miracle, because we will make those buses fast and free. These policies are not simply about the costs we make free, but the lives we fill with freedom.
What's going on in America?
What's going on in America? Well, do you want a proper answer or some bullshit? Proper answer? I think probably you're at the in the middle of the fourth turning. If you're familiar with, there's a historian called Neil Howe. He's the guy that coined the phrase millennial. And he believes that history runs in large cycles. There's been four of these in America so far. Think of 2008, the financial crash, as 1929. And the period we're in now is a war. It's the equivalent of World War II. And it's not one big war, and it's not total war. It's happening in different ways. But we're in a war, and culture will be reinvented in the first turning. But America's going through this now. There's a revolution taking place. Because if you think about what a revolution is, it's the replacement of elites. And that's what's happening. Marxism was about the redistribution of wealth. American Marxism, which is what woke is, American Marxism, is about the redistribution of status. And status is being redistributed in America. So it's a very tumultuous time.
If we want to get into the mindset of the philosophy, and this is all about philosophy, again, a generalization, and we all generalize, but people in general are products of their environment, of their of the people around them, where you were born. If I was born in Saudi Arabia, I'd be a Muslim. I would wear Saudi garb. I would have the same values as a Saudi. Even though I have free will and people who are born in a particular culture do leave it, Ayaan Hirsi Ali comes to mind. What prompted Ayaan Hirsi Ali to leave her culture was she read Nancy Drew. So it was just this little one voice that came to her that made her leave her culture, for better or for worse. And the same is for everybody. I was born in the province of Newfoundland. I was taught by Jesuits. I was brought up Catholic. I was an altar boy. But I have free will. And there's so many very myriad influences on a person that you can choose when you become an adult, what you want to do, where you want to place your philosophy, how you want to act, how you want to be moral or immoral. And I think when Marx came out with the Communist Manifesto, this was about 50 pages long. Imagine a little booklet, 50 pages long, by some, by all accounts, a slob, an unemployed slob, changed the world. And through that work, he developed, other people followed along, the Frankfurt School. Frankfurt School, people may have recognized that school of thought. That started after, in the 1920s, when these intelligentsia in Germany couldn't understand why the world wasn't turning to Marxism. They start the Frankfurt School to look at the economics. Well, maybe it's the economics. Well, of course, that's a failure. And then later on, they turned into the social aspects of it, the cultural aspects, and started studying that. And then that school gave rise to other schools of thought, the post-structuralists in the 60s and the 80s, the deconstructionists. Again, I'll throw some names out there. People may recognize Michel Foucault, perhaps the most cited scholar ever in history. Over a million citations. People go to this man and take his work. Jacques Derrida. And then from that, the post-structuralist, you got postmodernist identity-based critiques. And then to wokeism, what we're experiencing today for the last, 15 years or so? Identity politics, power structures, cultural critiques. But all of them have one thing in common, and that is they're subjectivist. Marx was a subjectivist in that he did not understand human nature. He thought of us as cogs in a wheel, as deterministic mechanisms that he could control, or that at least should have been controlled by the powers that be, to come to his agenda, the workers of the world unite type of thing, overthrow the bourgeoisie. And he didn't understand that human beings don't work like that. And the same with the postmodernists, the deconstructionalists, the woke people. They're all subjectivists. The world is what I want it to be. You and I, Rashid, I've watched a little bit of your stuff. I think that you would agree, and please tell me if I'm wrong, that we believe that the world has an objective truth to it.
Yes.
Okay, good. We're on the same page. Good. That's always good. There's an objective truth to the world. The universe, the reality is what it is, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. And if we want to command it, we have to obey it. Not so for all of the people who think that because you're a man, you feel like a woman, that you can just change, or vice versa, or any of those kinds of things. Just the other day, I saw somebody saying that mathematics was racist because 2 + 2 may or may not equal 4. That's a rather, dictatorial attitude to have. It could be 5. This is what we're dealing with. This is the psychology, which is a function of the philosophy, the prevailing philosophy of the world, which is subjectivist. Now, this is the people. This is the newspapers. This is the media. This is Hollywood. And as far as the politicians go, to get directly to your question about their psychology, they rule who represent society the best. So people in the West, at least, gravitate to those people, politicians, who are going to best represent their philosophy, their culture. So that's why you see in your Congress or in our Parliament, people who exemplify what I'm talking about, subjectivists, backing things like gender fluidity and things of that nature, tacitly, never even questioning it. If an authoritarian figure says something, they immediately go to it and obey it. This is subjectivism as well. It's not critical. Even though the Frankfurt School and the deconstructionists and the wokists were all apparently critiques of institutions, they don't critique their own systems of thought. For them, it's authoritarian. What they say goes. And if you dare to question it, you're canceled. You're killed. You at least cannot have any career advancements if, for example, if you're in the media or academe or anything like that. And I've seen it firsthand, personal friends destroyed like this because they would dare even question what's going on. Some have spent time in jail. Like yourself, you get to meet some really interesting people. And I've looked at some of your guests. I mean, Scott Ritter, I mean, Larry Johnson, Salim Ansar. All of these are great people with a lot of knowledge. And I think that, like yourself, I too have started to assimilate everything that we take in from these great guests. and it changes our ways of thinking. That's why we can think critically about ourselves. These other people, I think you may notice, they could never, ever criticize themselves. Can you imagine a Joe Biden admitting that he's wrong, or a Barack Obama, or somebody like that, Nancy Pelosi, you know, oh, I was wrong. Never, never criticize yourself. But people on our side of the story are always criticizing ourselves. That's probably sometimes why people on our side of the aisle are always at each other's throats, because they're always critiquing each other and critiquing themselves. Well, I changed my views over the last 25 odd years, but mostly in the last 5 years. And I've seen professors and people whose job it was to tell people the way it was in the world become despondent over the fact that what they've been teaching them over the years is wrong. And they're trying to reconcile what they now know from firsthand experience during the COVID years with what they've taught in the past 20, 30, 40 years in university, and it's tearing them apart. Mm-hmm. The same here. I mean, I could go back to some of the shows, and we're reaching on our radio show. We broadcast on shortwave. We used to broadcast on FM, but we were canceled because of our views. 944 episodes, I think, to date. I would like to go back and to touch on a few of the episodes that I did. Three or four come to mind, 9/11. Entering the war in Iraq, which Canada stayed out of, but the United States went to with the coalition of the willing, of course, things of that nature. And I'd like to go back and just say I was wrong about some of these things, because I've got new information which has changed my worldview. You'll never see that as part of the psychology of the people in power today. Again, with rare exception. And these people who are the rare exception usually end up getting the boot. Mm-hmm. So that in a nutshell, I think, may give you an understanding of what I think the philosophy, the psychology is of our leaders today, and why they're doing what they're doing. They're doing it because they're thugs and gangsters and criminals, and they don't care.
Yeah. You know, I've experienced the censorship, the shadow ban, the everything. I may have been the only show ever to be suspended off of air while I was doing an interview. They suspended me live on the air while I was doing an interview. Larry Johnson himself said that my show should have at least 100,000+ subscribers, and they keep my view counts artificially low. I'll go one day and it'll say 3,000 views, and I'll go back and it'll say 247 views and stuff like that. So I understand that the price of truth is that. My thoughts are, to put it like this, as long as I can reach a few people, that's what matters. It doesn't matter about the large view count or the large subscriber base or anything like this, because truth is ultimately the only thing that will help people navigate this matrix that we are now in. And when we look at the leadership, as you say, these people are thugs, and they have no self-awareness, I should say, no self-correction button in them. They will double down on failure. They will double down on bad policies. They will double down on policies that will become more detrimental to people, only to prove a point that they are the powerful, or they are the influential. For an example, when we look at American politics and American policies, instead of Trump backing down when he knew he was wrong with the sneak attack on Iran, they double down. They double down and triple down. And now they're planning for another attack. To me, this shows that they are not learning. They are just acting impulsively. And even at the cost of their own security and the well-being of their own people, they're doing it over and over again. And we can see that with the sanctions with Russia, how the European Union is putting up a 20-year sanction package. It is not in the least affecting Russia as they thought it would, but it is bringing Europe to a deindustrialization. It is also hammering the American workers at home. Why do you think that they are so hell-bent on trying to present themselves as powerful and that they can bring people to their knees, even while the reality is stating that the policies that they are putting in place are actually a detriment to their own political and economic survival and system?
I think there may be a couple of answers to that, or probably a myriad of answers, but a couple stand out because people are looking at what they're doing, Starmer, Macron, Trump, Carney here in Canada, and wondering why they are doing what they're doing when the obvious effect is detrimental or could have earth-shattering consequences like a nuclear war. And some conspiracy theories out there, and I think there's a lot of truth to it, is that they've been blackmailed. And whether or not that is true, you'll never find the evidence for that, because criminals don't usually keep records of their crimes, which is why when you look, people were anticipating the JFK files being released. I'm going, you're not going to see anything because this happened behind closed doors. Well, even with Epstein, now there may be something with Epstein because in order to hold something over somebody's head, they have to have some physical evidence. Mm-hmm. So there may be something there. I don't know. But I also think that they actually think that they're doing what the people want them to do. A recent poll in Canada showed a majority of people here would like Carney and the Liberal Party to continue to give money to Ukraine and Zelensky, even though they know it's just going to go down the toilet, or it's going to go to the military-industrial complex in the States, or it's going to go into Zelensky's own pocket. But they don't know these things, though. They're not taught them. That brings up another point, is that the media is in the pay of the politicians, at least here in Canada, to a smaller degree in the United States and other countries. But I don't know if people in the United States realize that. Of course, we have a state broadcaster, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC. They're always deferential to liberalism, and they're always critical of conservatism. But under Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, he started to fund the other media, except for outliers like Rebel News or True North.
Oh, hi, everybody. Ezra Levant here from Rebel News. I have something astonishing to show you. It's a 9-page year-end report from a social media app called Hootsuite, and it shows that in the past year, Rebel News has quadrupled our viewership. Our stories were seen a whopping 430,234,000 times in 2025. That's nearly half a billion. Now, I had a hunch this was happening even before I saw the report. A recent study by Reuters and Oxford University said that Rebel News is now the third most mentioned Canadian video channel, ahead of Global News even. We're only behind CBC and CTV. More than any other force in the media, Rebel News is spreading the messages of freedom across Canada.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
People out there who don't turn into shows like the Red Pill Diaries or Just Right Media or you name them, a Joe Rogan or whoever, they're not getting the other side of the story. They've never heard of anybody that I would mention. Jordan Peterson, followed by millions. Never heard him. That's how bad it is out there. All they do is they watch the local news or the CBC, CTV, Global, in your neck of the woods, MSNBC, Fox, CNN. And they're inundated with the official party line. So the politicians know this. The pollsters tell them what the people want based on what they have been fed by the media that has been bought and paid for by the politicians. So that's why they're doing what they're doing. I think that's the biggest part of it, is that they want to retain power like any thug and gangster wants to. They want to maintain their position of corruption and the salaries and the perks that go along with it. You know, flying the jets all over around the world, meeting and glad-handing actual people of merit like an Elon Musk or or some of the movers and shakers of the world, because they have nothing to offer. And so they live vicariously by the people that they meet as leaders, as long as they can keep control and keep getting elected. So they pay the media to tell the narrative that they then exemplify as politicians. So that's why we're in Ukraine. That's why we have the views that we do. That's why the United States has a neoconservative foreign policy detrimental to keeping America first. So those are just a couple of things. Probably the media influenced by corruption and blackmail. They grow up in cliques. Here in Canada, we call them the Laurentian elite. Of course, the St. Lawrence River, basically from Toronto all the way down to Quebec City, Montreal, Ottawa, Kingston. People are born in this strip, in this huge country, the second largest in the world. They grow up on this strip. They go to the best schools. They know all of the people who are the players. And this elite, the Laurentian elite, as we call them, with rare exception, become the leaders. So you got cliques, you've got blackmail, you've got the media. Have I missed anything?
Well, you know, that's a double-edged sword also for the policies that they put in play to keep power and to maintain wealth. They also dumb down the population. And while dumbing down the population, it is like sending a time bomb to the base of your republic or your country, because these are the people that you're dumbing down, or your future scholars, doctors, lawyers, politicians, everybody. And when you give them this false narrative and then expect them to compete with the rest of the world that is getting a better and bigger picture over the years and over the decades, you'll see that they start lagging behind. And I think this is where the Western world is right now. And they're starting to lash out because the policies of their politics is now catching up with them, and they're losing their edge technologically, militarily, economically, industrially. And I think this is all a part of the push in Ukraine, the war with Iran, the destabilization of the Sahel, the embargo on Cuba through Venezuela. I think this is a lashing out because the blowback effect, everything that you do has a reaction. And I think the policies that they've implemented is now there's a blowback effect on those policies that they've enacted over the years. What have you to say on that?
Well, I agree with what you've just said. And there's a blowback. We're living in an interesting time. Gad Saad, I don't know if you're familiar with Gad Saad, Canadian pundit, university professor, now in America, I believe. But he was on our program as well, and he wrote a book, The Parasitic Mind. And he was talking about how when Elon Musk bought X, it was the most important thing he ever did or will ever do. And I'd have to agree with him, because while Elon may have Starlink, which, by the way, I'm using, he may be putting man on Mars, which will be fantastic. He may have Tesla, which, again, is a great product. But the best thing that anybody could ever do was make speech free and open, because it's from that ideas happen. So you're right. The pushback is coming because of people like Elon opening up speech again. And you started off by saying something about the education. And this is another area that I have some familiarity with, not just personally, because as I mentioned before, I was taught by Jesuits and Christian Brothers. By the way, Salim was as well. Salim Mansur was taught by Jesuits in East Pakistan. And if Jesuits know anything, it's a love of knowledge and a love of education. And I think that was instilled in me at an earlier age. And when I read a book, it was just a polemic, Why Johnny Can't Read. I had just had a couple of children, and they were going to go into school. And I was livid at what I was going to be putting them into. So luckily, I put them into Montessori at the beginning so that they could at least learn how to read and write and cipher, which they did quite well. But when they got into public school, I was aghast at the level of education and the degradation of the educational methods over the years. But we learned phonetically. We learned the sounds of the alphabet and how they go into make up words. But then they went to look say, and then they went to child-centered learning, which was a broader envelope for nobody fails. I even asked, when I was a trustee, I asked the chief administrator of the board for London, and by the way, this is a $1 billion budget, 5,000 employees. How many students has the system failed last year? And he said, none. My response, then what value is an education? If anybody can pass through it without any blowback, to use your words, for doing wrong, for failing, then what's the value of a diploma? What's the value of a grade 12 education anymore when the stupidest person gets it just as much as the brightest person? And to that point, we are bringing up a population of people who don't know how to put two sentences together, who can't write cursively.
No.
That's going to be a secret code for us in the future. We just want to write a note cursively and hand it to another person of our age, and a young person won't be able to read it. But you see some of the man on the street interviews. PragerU sometimes does them. You go out there and you say, you know, on July 4th, what are we celebrating? Oh, July 4th. Oh, yeah, what's that about? Not a clue. The other part of the equation is that the populace itself has become, through no fault of their own, really stupid by design, intentionally dumbed down, so that they will take tacitly anything that an authoritarian says. The World Health Organization says, do this. Yes, sir. We'll go do that. And everybody jumps. How dare you go against a Dr. Fauci? How dare you go against the Bill Gates or a Joe Biden, for God's sake? You know, so you brought up this point of education. I hope I didn't digress too much, but education is a huge part of why we are in the situation we are today.
And I always say that because I think the wise of the wise should understand that when you defund education and you dumb down the educational system, you're dumbing down the thing that educates and civilizes the very masses of the people that are supposed to be the base of society. And when you do that, as I said, you lay a nuclear bomb at the base of your republic or your society. And I think more scholars and more scientists and more politicians should look at that, because if they don't, what we're watching is the fall of America, the fall of Canada, the fall of the Western world. And I think they dismiss that because they have become so pompous, so arrogant in their power and in their wealth, that they just say that we can keep what we have going on in perpetuity, not realizing that everything comes to an end.
You know, when I was a public school trustee, I would say publicly, do not put your kids in the public education system. And of course, everybody's aghast that here I am as a trustee saying that the system is absolutely detrimental to education. I would rather see a child not get formally educated than to be miseducated in a public school system. I don't know the school system in the United States.
It sucks.
Yes. Well, you'd have down there things like charter schools and a lot of private schools, some up here as well, not so many charter schools, but private schools and Christian schools that people can circumvent the public education system, which teaches no values at all. It is amoral. At least with a religious education, you have morals, right? And if the child later on decides that, you know, I don't want to follow the religion, then it has been inculcated into them that there is such a thing as morality. Mm-hmm. While in the public education system, everything was amoral. There is no objective truth. There is no standard by which you should judge your behavior when you go out into society. You are your own moral compass. So I think that, yeah, not even putting them in school, just letting them pick it up from their parents or priests or neighbors is better than being taught something that is fundamentally wrong, fundamentally can destroy not only their chances of survival academically or career-wise, but fundamentally destroy their own self-worth.
And I also think that it's a reflection of the political system, because if you look at the disregard for property, life, differences of opinion, critical thinking skills, all we have to do is look at a political system in the United States or in the Western world, and we'll see that the school system is a reflection of that and vice versa. Just like if we look at the foreign policy of America, we see it as a microcosm of the domestic politics. And this is the catch-22 of the Western world. They have now been caught in that cycle. And they're pointing the finger at China, they're pointing the finger at Russia, they're pointing the finger at nations that are striving to decolonize, they're pointing the finger at everybody except the people who are most at fault, and those are those who rule them and who continue to hold an iron grip over the educational system of these Western nations.
There's so much to unpack there. You're absolutely right. It's a vicious circle, isn't it? And the catch-22, if people remember, we throw that phrase around, but the person in the book was trying to get out of being in the military by saying that he was insane. The catch was that no insane person would say that they're insane. They all think that they're sane. So there's your catch. So the minute you say you're insane, you can't be insane. And this is what we see with our politicians, isn't it? None of them are saying that they're insane. Mm-hmm. All the emperors are wearing no clothes. Mm-hmm. Everybody, nobody wants to point it out, especially in the media. You and I will, and our minority will. But everybody's just looking at the emperors out there naked and going, everything's fine.
Do you think there should be a limit on the kind of people that are allowed on X?
No, I'm actually very much, Pierce, a free speech absolutist. And the example that I like to give is, despite my personal history in the Middle East, despite being Jewish, I support the right of Holocaust deniers to spew their endless nonsense. And so you can't be a free speech absolutist and say, no, but not for this case. I'm a free speech absolutist, but not for Donald Trump. Not for Donald Trump. Mm. I believe in journalistic integrity, but not when it comes to Hunter Biden's laptop, in which case we should have all colluded to suppress it. That's what a consequentialist ethic is. That's wrong, right? There are certain principles that have to be deontological, meaning they're absolute foundational positions that you never violate, short of the regular caveats. You can't defame, you can't directly incite to violence, right? You could criticize Judaism all you want till pigs fly, but you can't say, let's go to the corner of 6th and Broadway and kill the Jews when they come out of the synagogue. Short of that, all bets are off. Anything is allowed to be said, and let better ideas defeat idiotic.
To me, there are some limits. I mean, if Adolf Hitler was on X right now, spewing his hateful views of Jewish people, I would assume that Elon Musk would have him removed.
It's going to shock you what I'm going to say. By the way, there are endless, on any given day, incredible anti-Semites that come after me, and yet I would never presume to call Elon and say, hey, Elon, you should see the stuff that they're saying about me. Please take them off. Mm. And so I walk the walk and I talk the talk.
Yeah.
Part of being in a free society is to be able to withstand cretins, falsehood spreaders, liars, racists, Jew haters. Again, as long as you don't defame, as long as you don't directly incite to violence, all bets are off.
I want to play a little clip from your interview with Elon. This is about where he talks about optimism v. pessimism.
All of these parasitic ideas originated from, you know, the university ecosystem. So can we be optimistic that we could turn this thing around, Elon, or are we just screaming in the wind?
Well, I think we have to be optimistic. I agree with my general philosophy is that it's better to be on the side of being optimistic and wrong than pessimistic and right.
There was also another bit I like on fame, happiness, and money. And you put to him the thesis of your new book, that happiness and money are only linked up to a point below $100,000. And he actually agreed with you, which, given he's worth about $250 billion, was quite funny. Let's take a listen.
In fact, I'd say there's a decrease in happiness that occurs when the fame level exceeds that which is useful. So, like, there's a certain, you know, modicum of fame where you can now get, it's easy to get a reservation at a restaurant.
Right.
That's like you want that level of fame and not anything beyond it.
I kind of know what he means. I do think he's trying to be a force for good in the world. I think that's his driving, motivating factor. There was one other bit from the interview you did with Elon this week, which I liked. This was about the doomsday scenario. If AI is allowed to continue being obviously transparently woke. Let's take a listen to this.
It's going to be leading to some pretty dangerous and bizarre outcomes. And it could actually, like, if it's been taught, like, that misgendering is worse than nuclear war, it may decide that to avoid misgendering, it should start a nuclear war. The surefire way to stop any future misgendering is to kill all humans.
Right, exactly.
problem solved. No more misgendering.
I mean, he's kind of joking, but he's kind of not. He's, you know, I think if AI does become sentient and it's being guided by very woke minds, human minds, to think a certain way, then it really could be Armageddon, couldn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think one of the reasons why my 2020 book, The Parasitic Mind, resonated so much with people is because I basically argue, and I think that's one of the ways that Elon and I first connected, he also argues that the woke mind virus is arguably the greatest existential threat that humanity faces. Because, you know, all of the tragedies that we typically think of originally start off in the mind of some deranged lunatic, right? Whether it be Hitler or whether it be the super progressive academics that have been poisoning the minds of our children, it results in a departure from reason. So I think Elon and I see eye to eye when we say that much bigger than the COVID virus are the mind viruses that are burrowing in our brains.
Some people are very dumb about nuclear weapons and they go, yeah, we've got them and oh, they're so risky. And what they don't see is they go, oh, nuclear weapons, they've been used twice, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I would say, no, they've been used every fucking day since. We've just had the longest period of global peace in humanity and it's thanks to in nuclear weapons. It's thanks to fucking America. Pax Americana. Thanks. Well, people don't say it, but thanks. I mean, it's slightly, the unipolar world is slightly falling apart and we're becoming a multipolar world and we're fucked. We may need some more submarines.
What do you think is going through the minds of the Western world as they see the global South rise? Since you deal with psychology, because when you've ruled so dominantly for so long, and then you see that everything that you once have been able to control or interdict, when you see that is now out of your grip or grasp, what do you think is going on in the mind of the leadership of the Western world, specifically America, then Europe, then the other people that follow along with the United States?
Hard to say what goes on in their minds other than, how can I feather my nest? Again, they're a bunch of thugs and criminals and gangsters. So what goes through their mind is themselves. But if we want to talk maybe the intelligentsia, the scholars out there who are looking at culture change so rapidly. I was born in the 60s, early 60s. If you've ever seen the movie A Christmas Story.
Yeah, I was just watching it a few days ago. Yeah.
A Wonderful Christmas Story. That's the kind of Christmas I remember, even though that took place in the 50s. Again, I was in Newfoundland, so they're always 10 years behind anyway, culturally. But that's the kind of society I remembered. That's gone. It can never come back. And I think we have to understand that. That can never come back. What gets me is the rapidity with which cultural norms have changed from those idyllic, if somewhat naive times, because that was the time of the JFK assassination. And so we know things were going on behind the scenes that the media were not covering. There was no X, there was no social media, there was no shows like yours or mine to point out the inconsistencies of what we see and what the media tells us, to go from those times to today with the complete destruction, and I mean complete destruction, of our society. It just boggles my mind. And I'm only 64 years old. So in that time period, one lifetime, we've seen a destruction, a massive destruction. Salim once used a phrase, a Götterdämmerung. It's from an opera where the gods, if something can't belong to them, they'll destroy it. And that's what I think is happening with people like Nancy Pelosi. When she tore up Trump's speech, which, by the way, is a crime and should be indicted for, that was a defining moment. Here's Trump giving accolades to people and veterans and kids and saying, you know, the good things that he wants to keep within the United States and have them endure, and she rips it up. That was a defining moment, at least visually. Now, don't get me wrong, I think that Trump, for me, has been a great disappointment. As much as I did support him in the past, there are so many things right now that disappoint that I had to be very careful when I say anything about Trump. It's like, this I support, this I do not. You know, when's he going to visit Fort Knox, for example? When's he going to get rid of the Board of Education? By the way, Salim, on our show, predicted Trump would win at the same time that pundits like Ann Coulter did. By the way, Ann was on our show as well. And they are predicting this, and everybody just laughed at them, quite visibly just laughed at them. And Salim said, nope, here's the stats, here's the figures, this is why Trump will win. That's when he came down the escalator, Salim Ansar called it. So he was a big fan. But since then, not so much. Anyway, I think I've digressed from what you were originally asking.
But I'm glad that you did, because we have to understand Trump's beginning, because he made his money in the casinos also. So he had connection with gangsters and stuff. I call it from Obama to all of them, and their interconnection with crime and the Clinton family, all of this. And I want to play something for you since you got on that subject. This is from Jeffrey Sachs. Okay, and he's quoting Russian President Vladimir Putin.
There's a wonderful, I don't know, wonderful, my wife doesn't like me to use that word when I refer to President Putin's statements. I will say just very accurate. And that is in an interview that President Putin gave to Le Figaro in 2017, he has an observation which I found very astute. Or very accurate. He said, you know, I've dealt with three presidents now. He says they come to office with ideas, but then soon enough, the men in dark suits and blue ties show up and tell them the way the world really is. And that is why things continue as they are, essentially, no matter who is in office.
So the deep state will not allow you into a position unless they have something on you. And for you to ascend to that, you've had to have connections, because if we look at the whole situation, go back to the Epstein thing, Obama, Clinton, we see Trump, and these people, they rubbed elbows with Epstein constantly. And before Epstein, they rubbed elbows with each other. So to me, they play on the desires of the people. I'll change this. Look at what Obama did. Change, change, change. And he comes into office. And what change did he provide? More change out of the people's pockets that are poor into the richer people's pocket. And we look at Trump. No more wars. And look at him starting wars with Venezuela and starting wars with Iran and all of this stuff. I think that they do this. They have to play upon their base. And I think the deep state looks and say, okay, these people are disgruntled. We'll offer them something of what they want, and this candidate will allow this candidate to ascend. And then they'll speak to the issues of those people. But when you really look at the policies, they never actually hit the issues really of what the people wanted. And I say that because you can look at the MAGA base and how they're splitting off and how they're getting fed up with Trump promises. it goes to show you that President Putin had it right when he said that people come to office with good ideas sometimes, but then soon those people in black suits pull up and say, hey, this is how it works. This is how it's going to happen. And if you don't, you'll end up like JFK.
I think it's quite true. It's unfortunate, but I don't necessarily want to suggest that Trump, because of the people he has pictures with, is like those people. You don't get to be in his position, or even to be a president of the United States or a great businessman, without hobnobbing with the rich and famous. That's part of the networking apparatus that you have to do. It's how often do you do it after you find out that the guy is a reprobate, that the guy is bad? Like a Clinton, he knew all about Epstein. Of course, he was part of the whole thing. Trump, not so much. So you can't be a mover and shaker unless you hobnob with the movers and shakers. Oh, here's a picture of FDR with Stalin. Of course, they were negotiating the end of the war. And then at the second point, yes, the people in the dark suits and the blue ties, absolutely. The bureaucracy is a huge juggernaut. I think it was Trump who actually first used, during a press conference, the term deep state. The term had been bandied about before, but here you have the president of the United States talking about the deep state in those terms, which I found amusing. So he is being pushed in directions he probably doesn't want to go in.
Do you think the West will survive in this position? Because Europe, which has little to no resources, and the United States, which is now in a debt spiral, the likes of which we've never seen before. And even though it is rich in minerals, to tap those minerals now costs an exorbitant amount of money, which the United States no longer has.
You asked whether or not the West will survive this political shift from a unipolar hegemony of the United States being on top. So will it survive this unipolar hegemony? No, it's already lost that. This is not a unipolar hegemony world anymore. And whether that is good or bad, I don't know. I think it's probably for the best. So will the West as a collective survive? Yeah, I think we'll survive. We don't have to be on top. We just have to think of ourselves as individuals, as people, as Chinese, as Japanese, as Ecuadorians, as Americans, Canadians, British, German, Russians, Ukrainians, and that we all want the same thing, which is peace and to flourish as individuals. At least that's the majority of us want that. And I think we have to understand through shows like yours and social media that we're being really sold a bill of goods by our politicians. And we have to be critical and really hold their feet to the fire and throw the bums out if they're not following an objective reality where there are objective truths and an objective morality. So, yeah, we'll survive.
Thank you so much for joining me on the Red Pill Diaries. We're going to have to get you back on the platform. I really, really appreciate it. And I want you to have a blessed and safe day. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rasheem. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for all you do.
Once again, that was our own Robert Vaughn in conversation with Rashid Mohammed, host of the Red Pill Diaries, and the complete video can be accessed from several Red Pill Diaries platforms, including YouTube and Rumble, as well as from our own homepage at justrightmedia.org. So do you think the West will survive? Well, let's hope that it lasts at least long enough for you to join us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Why do you love royal Saudi?
Why do you like royal Saudi cock? Oh! This is about the gig I did in Riyadh. I will tell you all about it, my friend. I tell you what they've got in Saudi Arabia, and you'll be interested in this. People. And those people, you won't imagine, this will blow your mind. They like going out to shows. You know, like you.